we're talking about practical protection for personal storage.
So this is some work that I've done with my colleague, Paul Stanton, and my advisors, John Linwood Griffin and Randall Burns. This talk is divided basically into two sections. The first one, I'm going to talk about the problem, namely how personal storage today looks and the issues that arise there. And then I'm going to talk about our solution. And the title didn't give it away. It's about protection mechanisms. This is how the Web 2.0 looks today, at least from a user's perspective. Here in the middle, we have Alice. Alice uses a number of Web 2.0 services. She blogs on LiveJournal. She uses Facebook, Google Docs for editing, Flickr for her photos, and Hotmail for her email. She uses a lot of services. And in the future, we expect that people are going to be using even more services, not just a handful, but perhaps dozens. And the thing that you notice immediately about this architecture is that each of the services has its own storage. When Alice wants to access her photos on Flickr, she needs to go through Flickr, or at least go through Flickr's API in order to access the data. And one of the major resulting implications of this architecture is that sharing between services is limited. And you can see this limitation in the way that you, for instance, share your address book. If you want to import friends on Facebook, then you can do that. And Facebook has a little app that you put in your username and login for Hotmail. And then Facebook goes ahead, logs into your Hotmail account, and can send email as you and read all your email. And oh, by the way, it also downloads all of your address book, which is nice. So we've identified an emerging issue in this architecture for the users. And that namely is that data management is hard. And there's three separate problems here that are related. The first one has to do with data lock-in. And we mean data lock-in in a particular way. It's not that the user can't get her data out of a service provider. It's just that it's hard to access the data. There's no standardized interfaces. Facebook has published a description of their API, and anybody could write a tool for it. But the point is that to write any tool, you must write a point solution for every service that you want to support. And there are a lot of services out there. The second problem is data spew, which is that right now, Alice uses Flickr for her photos. And so if she's looking for a photo, then she can create the association that, oh, right, my photos, I use Flickr, and therefore it's probably stored on Flickr. But, you know, what happens when she uses more? What happens when she edits a photo in Google Docs? Now she has photos in multiple places, and there's no logical connection. So her data's all over the place, and she can't organize it the way she wants. And finally, there's version drift. And this has to do with copying the file in multiple places. So Alice has her photo on Facebook, on Flickr, and then she wants to edit it on Google Docs. She has to download it. She uploads it back to Google Docs, and now there's two copies. She edits it on Google Docs and then doesn't synchronize the edits with Flickr. Somebody goes ahead and tags her photo on Flickr. That, of course, introduces updates to the photo, and now she has to manually resolve these two copies. So what's the underlying problem? There's just too many storage providers. At least there's too many perceived storage providers. What Alice wants is a unified view of her data. Now, there's a simple solution to this, which is just one storage provider. At least one storage provider per user. We're not saying that some government come and set up a particular storage provider and that every user is bound to use this. But that one user can choose from a small set of storage providers. For instance, Amazon S3 or Rackspace. And the result is that we have this architecture where Alice is able to directly access her data from her storage provider using her storage provider's API. There's a single authoritative copy, which is stored at her storage provider. And all of her service are able to access this copy. And this, of course, facilitates cross-service sharing. There's only a single backend. And now, when Alice wants to open a photo in Google Docs, She simply navigates to the photo that Flickr is accessing also from her storage. But there's a simple difficulty as well. And the simple difficulty has to do with access control. We still don't want Facebook to be able to access our email. And now, with a single storage solution, it's even easier. But can't we rely on reputation? Doesn't Facebook have a reputation to preserve? And the answer is, of course, yes. But if we rely on reputation, then we have an issue that it's going to hamper innovation. We're scared to try new services because they're unknown. They might access all of our data. They might delete our data. They might modify it secretly. And this, of course, raises the barrier to entry, and we want to prevent this. And of course, we don't really want to rely on reputation anyways. So I think I've motivated the problem, which is that we can't manage our data today. It's getting even worse. How can we fix it? And one solution is to use this unified storage model. But again, there's an issue, and that has to do with protection. And so now I'm going to introduce some protection mechanisms that we came up with. Here are our four major design goals. The first one has to do with protection. And this one is, we want to operate under a least privileged regime. What this means is that we don't want a system that looks like Unix, where all applications are able to access all of your data. This is exactly the problem that we've identified. Now, it may be okay on Unix and Windows, but we really want fine-grained, dynamic delocation and revocation in our system. We want to be able to say that Facebook should only be able to access our address book and a couple of other files and not be able to access our email. Now, least privilege has an issue, or at least a perceived issue, and this has to do with usability. And these lead to our three usability goals. The first one is that we really want to minimize the number of interactions that a user has with the security manager. If the user has to interact with the security manager every single time she wants to open a file, it's going to become a burden. The security cannot become a burden. We need to be able to access or delegate access to objects that don't exist. For instance, on Flickr, the user thinks of the security policy here as being, I want Flickr to be able to access all of my JPEG files. It's a simple policy. But if we look at it statically and we say, find all of the JPEG files on my hard drive or on my storage, and then give Flickr access to that, every single time Alice uploads new photos, she's going to have to run the security policy again. We want to be able to enable future delegations. And finally, we want to be able to have consistent naming of objects. If we're operating under a least privileged regime and different principles see different namespaces, Alice should nevertheless always recognize or be able to name a particular object using the same name in every namespace. So to solve this, we've come up with a framework, and we've implemented the framework in the context of a system called S4, which stands for a simple, secure storage service. And it's essentially an extension to S3. There are three major components of the system. The first one has to do with hierarchical principles. The second one is how we do our protection mechanism, which is based on filtered views. And finally, we introduce a way to integrate the power box into our system, into this distributed system, which is when the security manager implements open and save as dialog boxes on behalf of the application. And I'll get into how that works exactly. But let's first take a look at principles. So I said that our principles are hierarchical. What that means is that Alice is up here. She has access to all of her files. And subordinate to her is, for instance, her Alice.hotmail principle and her Alice.facebook principle. So she is able to control what they see. Now, we could imagine that there are further principles. For instance, Facebook has apps. Facebook might provide some mechanisms to delegate more restricted views of what Facebook can see to those apps, but let's just stay simple for the moment. Principles are identified to the storage server using public key cryptography, and there's nothing terribly special there. That's just something that we're reusing from S3. So if we introduce principles, we need some way to create them, and this is how creating a principle essentially looks on our system. Alice goes to her security manager, and she wants to create a new principle. Pops up a simple dialog box. What is the pet name? What is the name of the service as Alice sees it? Let's call it Facebook, but she could call it whatever she likes. And then she has a personal association for what this service is. And that's all she needs to enter. She clicks on OK, and she gets a web key. She provides this web key to Facebook. The web key is a URL. It includes the service's public and private keys, and it also can potentially include a signature of the server, so that way the service knows that it is indeed talking to the right storage server, and there's no man in the middle of the attack. So I've told you about principles. Let's talk a little bit about filtered views. A view is essentially a query over the user's namespace. Up here we have Alice again. Alice has a number of files, her address book, her mail directory, her photos, her calendar, etc. And she wants Hotmail to only have access to her address book and her mail directory. So she creates two rules. The first one gives read and write access to her address book, and the second one gives read and write access to her mail directory. So, the way this works is that we view Alice's namespace, we apply the filters to the namespace, and the things in bold are the things that match, and those are the things that Hotmail can access. Now, in our particular implementation, we're using regular expressions, but one could imagine using anything one likes, for instance, SQL queries. The nice thing about this is that since we're doing matching on the namespace, this enables consistent naming and future delegations. Now, it's important to note at this point that we're not expecting the user to enter regular expressions or come up with SQL queries. This is a bit too advanced. Certainly, it's available to the power user, but it doesn't mean that the Alice, let's assume that she's not a power user, has to use them. Instead, she would use the power box. So, what's the issue when we're running under a least privileged regime? Well, Google Docs doesn't have access to anything, for instance. And that is what, and this view here on the left is what we would see if Alice did a file open from Google Docs. She essentially has no files. Of course, she has a whole lot of files. It's just that Google Docs can't see them. So on the right here, we see the power box view, or namely, the security manager's view, the files that she really has. And here they are, they're all available. So how does Alice delegate access to Google Docs? Really, she just wants to do file open and see a normal open dialog. Well, the simple way is that she grant access to Google Docs to all of her files. Violates the least privilege principle. So this is where the power box comes in. The power box is a simple idea that we didn't come up with, was used in the CapDesk system, but it's an idea that we've shown how to implement in the context of a distributed system. And the basic idea is that instead of the application implementing its own open or save as dialog box, it makes an RPC to the security manager. And then the security manager displays the box. This means that the security manager has full access to all the files. It can show all of Alice's files to Alice. And when she's done and has chosen a file, the power box then can go ahead and delegate access. This is essential for least privilege. It enables dynamic delegation, by which we mean delegation at runtime, and it doesn't require any explicit user interactions with the security manager. Why do I say no explicit interactions? Because Alice is doing the exact same thing she's always done. She's using an open or save as dialog box. Yet, she's interacting with the security manager. We're reusing her action, her designation, in order to identify her security policy intent. So how would we integrate the power box into, for instance, Flickr? Well, let's imagine that Alice goes and creates an account at Flickr.com. Now she's going to actually have to interact with the security manager. She's going to need to create a principal for Flickr. We saw how that worked. It was pretty easy. Alice then would give the credentials to Flickr, and Flickr would start an import photos wizard. It would invoke the power box. The power box would pop up at the user's computer, just as usual. And the question would be, what photos would you like to import into Flickr? And the suggestion would be, for instance, all JPEG files. And it's as easy as that. So what's the difference from now? Well, there's one additional step, which is creating a new principal. But on the other hand, Alice can use her own tools to upload photos, and she doesn't have to upload them individually. They're already on her storage provider. So it might even be easier. So how does the protocol look? Well, down here, we have Alice. She's sitting at her web browser. This is everything that's running on Alice's computer. And she does file open on Google Docs. This goes through her browser to Google Docs. Google Docs says, oh, okay, I'm not going to show my own open or save as dialog box. Instead, I'm going to do power box invoke. Now, Google Docs doesn't know the address of the security manager. And in fact, Alice might have multiple devices. So the question is, well, which security manager should Google Docs be using? Well, we don't require Google Docs to know this. Instead, Google Docs goes ahead and talks to the storage manager. The security managers have all registered with the storage provider. And so the storage provider simply forwards the request to all of Alice's security managers. And then the security manager opens a dialog box. Now, hopefully, one of them is running on the computer that Alice is currently browsing from. It pops up the open dialog box, looks like it's coming from Google Docs. Alice interacts with it. And then when she hits OK, the security manager now does the delegation that she indicated, also sends a power box close. This causes all other power boxes to also be closed. And then Google Docs gets the answer, knows which file the user selected, and can continue as usual. Now, there's potentially an issue with the system that we've come up with, which is performance. If all of these services are now accessing Alice's data on, for instance, S3 over a wide area network, it's going to be slow. Well, at least in the paper, we were particularly careful to say that the storage provider is only holding the authoritative copies of the user's data. So the services can cache. Indeed, they should cache in the case of Flickr. But what they should do is promptly propagate updates to the authoritative copy. A second issue is adoption. Well, clearly users want it, right? It's going to improve their usability, we think, and improve their control over their data. That's great. But the problem is that the current services, Facebook is going to lose control, right? They have to cede control to the user. This is not what they want. But it is a differentiator for new service providers. So if someone comes along and says, hey, I have the exact same service that Flickr has, but you're in control of your data, users might migrate. So we think that this is an opportunity. But the big service providers might want it as well. They want to be the storage provider. This would increase the amount of user traffic that they get and the duration with which they can capture users. So Facebook might come along and offer to be a storage provider. And if Facebook does it, well, then all the apps are going to do it, and all the new services that come out are also going to support this. So there is a real possibility, we think, that this type of architecture could be adopted. So have we implemented it? And the answer is yes, we've implemented a large portion of what we've described. It's 4,000 lines of Python, and it runs on a single machine and is single threaded. So it's a prototype. It's not something to rival S3, but it is S3 compatible. One of the ways that we tested it was that we ran S3 apps and had them connect to our service. And it uses S3 as its backend or an SQLite backend for storing files. The principles and the filter interfaces are essentially complete, as I described them, both here and in the paper. And some of the power boxes there. So a bit of future work. In fact, there's a lot of future work to be done here. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to filter based on the file's tags? For instance, maybe I tag some of my photos as being private. I don't want these photos to be made available to Flickr. How do we do that? How do we trust the tags? That's sort of more of the underlying issue, is that if you import a file and somebody has seeded it with some tags that are malicious, we have to now think about how the tags work. One thing that would be nice is to introduce snapshots to be able to enable recovery. In case a service goes ahead and does something bad, well, it can only do bad things to the data that it can access, but that can still be bad. So we'd like to be able to roll back. We'd like to provide a mechanism for copy on write. So we imagine that we have an untrusted service. We want to give that untrusted service access to some of our data. Now, we've disclosed the data, but we want to avoid the issue with rollback, which is that now we've mixed together some changes, good changes and bad changes, and we really only want to roll back the bad changes. Another issue is publish and subscribe for updates. So when I change my file or a photo on Google Docs, Flickr wants to know about it promptly. Or when I upload some data, Flickr wants to know about it promptly. Clearly, scanning is not the right answer here. We can imagine that there are malicious services out there which are going to try to do a financial attack by simply accessing data a lot. Some way we need to be able to throttle bandwidth. And the most interesting thing, I think, and I have no idea how to go about doing it, is how to not disclose content to the server. So there's a project called Tahoe, which is a capability-based file system, and the encryption keys are never enclosed to the storage provider. So all of the content that is on the storage provider is completely encrypted, and only the user is able to decrypt it. But it's still possible to do delegations and lots of nice things. Can we also integrate that into this model and still be able to do the type of security policies that we're interested in? So the summary. What's the bad? Well, that's the status quo, at least in particular, data lock-in, data spew, and version drift. And the good, well, that's what we try to solve, and that is a single perceived file system, least privilege, so that applications and services can't take advantage of you, minimizing the number of interactions that the user has with the service by way of a power box, and by way of coming up with protection mechanisms that match the user's intuition, which we think we've done. For instance, the ability to say all JPEG files, the ability to delegate access to objects that don't exist, and finally, consistent naming of objects. So what are the takeaways? For all of you that have been sleeping, checking your email, or otherwise haven't been paying attention, now here's your chance. Filtering matches how users think about security policies, and the power box is a really cool idea. And for details, read the paper. So some of the images, I'm not an artist, found them on the web, CC, public domain. And I'm happy now to take any questions that you might have.
Questions? Okay, I'll start the question.
Okay.
So these big sites, you know, like Facebook or something, I mean, if they use this service, they're basically creating a dependency that they don't have now, you know, for performance, availability, and those things. So do you think they would ever do it? You know, especially these big ones that needs, you know, very high scalability.
So the question is, do I think that big services would ever be willing to adopt this model? And the answer is, I think that users want it, and so I think it's a differentiator for new services, right? If you look at the evolution of the web and applications in general, every few years, there's an opportunity for somebody to come along and displace the big guys. It used to be MySpace, then Facebook came along. So I think that there is an opportunity here for somebody new to provide something that users want. And I think that the big service providers could potentially be interested in this type of thing because it would increase the traffic that they're seeing. So if somebody like my Facebook were to offer this service, then I think that a lot of the grassroots would adopt it, and that would create a lot of momentum. So I think that it is indeed realistic and something that we could see. My advisor is going to ask me a question now.
I actually don't know the answer to this question, which is, what's the outlook for providing the PowerBox interface to credential creation? I mean, could you abstract credentials as a file to deliver to a service?
That's a good question. So the question is, as I understand it, is do we really need the user to interact with the security manager to create the credentials? Couldn't we use the PowerBox? Well,
or something PowerBox-like.
Something PowerBox-like. How does this service, you're now at Flickr and you've registered your account, right? And Flickr says, well, I want to get access to your storage. Somehow you have to provide Flickr the information. Maybe the simplest thing is there's a pop-up box and you select your storage provider, right? And then there's also a thing for other. So maybe there's three or four major storage providers out there and you click on S4. And then it says, oh, S4, I know all about S4. And so it sends a message to S4, and then S4 sort of knows who you are now, and then pops up, talks to your security manager, and then pops up a PowerBox. And otherwise, if you do other, right, you're using one of these less well-known storage providers, then, well, you're forced to go through the security manager, but if you're using one of these minor players anyways, then you're probably more of a power user, at least a bit more informed than your average user. So maybe that's the answer.
Okay, one more. So you mentioned a bit the caching. I mean, can you talk a bit more about, you know, the interaction with performance mechanisms like caching and content distribution networks, for instance? Because, I mean, people have come up with, for instance, privacy violation attacks based on the properties of CDNs. So, can you give some detail about how you see this integrated with these performance-oriented mechanisms?
So, I'm not sure I understand the bit about privacy issues with content delivery networks.
Well, I mean, essentially, you're allowing a third, some other company to provide your data for performance, right?
So you're saying that I'm allowing Facebook to get access to my data for performance issues, or to cache my data for performance?
Facebook allows CDNs to cache data to, make Facebook faster.
So what I was thinking of in the context of caching is that Facebook and Flickr, these big service providers, they have the infrastructure already for storage. and they're interested in having the data locally so that they can do analysis and these other things. And so my expectation or my thoughts were that Facebook is going to download your data that you've already told Facebook it can access and cache it locally on their LAN. And they're going to use it there. So I hadn't really thought of the issue of third parties being able to access your data. It seems to me that there is a layered security approach here where you're giving, for instance, Flickr access to your data, and then you're telling Flickr, well, you can publish my photos. Well, once you tell Flickr that you can publish your photos, then doing it via content delivery network is not really an issue. Are there issues for other things? That's a good point. Perhaps there are.
Okay, let's think the speaker.